Continuing talking about evidences this evening, Isaiah, would you mind leading us in a word of prayer before you go on?
Sure. Let's pray. Father, we come before you tonight. We're thankful for all the little things you do for us each and every day, Lord. You are such a gracious Lord to us, and Lord, we are enamored by your power and by your mercy, Lord, that even though we sin, that you are willing to forgive us, Lord, through the blood of your Son. Lord, help us to study evidences tonight. Lord, help us to look and make logical conclusions about how you made the world, Lord, and help us to go out into the communities that we live in and help us convert more people to you, Lord, and help more people learn who you are and bring them to you, Lord. Help us to be lights in that community and help us, Lord, to always be more like your Son each and every day. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.
Amen. Okay, so we see on the screen there a very familiar verse to us. Genesis chapter 1, verse 1 says, "In the beginning God made the heavens and the earth." As we talked about in the prior study, there was a time not many years ago when virtually no one would have ever challenged such a statement like we read in Genesis chapter 1, verse 1, that our universe was created and that God was behind this creating was as sure in the mind of the greater populace as the rising and the setting of the sun. But times have changed. Skepticism is on the rise. And I think this is the case for several reasons. And this is going to be just a small review from what we talked about last week. But first, as we talked about the educational system, as y'all are very aware of, it just flooded with professors who are skeptics and who are biased. And unfortunately, good Christian parents are turning their children, even when they're young, over with their impressionable minds over to these educators, where they are inundated with anti-religious propaganda. And if they stand for the faith, they're ridiculed. Some of you have even spoken to me of some of these things. You'll be ostracized in class for your so-called ignorance and stupidity. Our young people are certainly going to have their taste fate tested here as they continue to get older, and I know that you young people are going through that as well in the universities. So that's one reason why skepticism is on the rise, just because of that alone. And of course, we understand that the media is becoming more anti-Christian as well, and this is evident in things like social media and the news. All you have to do to go to YouTube and look up some controversial religious topic, and you won't have to search very far to find somebody that is mocking that and is making mocking that seem like it's the cool thing to do. And third, even Christians are in a lot of ways falling off their spiritual duties because we're becoming prisoners to our schedules, becoming prisoners to our jobs and our hobbies, our phones, anything and everything that sometimes will keep us from assemblies such as this where we can come and have our faith and our hearts strengthened by the truth. And then fourth, skepticism is also on the rise because more and more Christians are really losing knowledge of just the vast amount of evidence that we actually have that certifies Christianity as the only valid religion that is out there. And so certainly those are things that we're going to see in our day and time. And I hope that this study is going to help to fix some of those problems for many of us. As Christians, we've got to be equipped with the knowledge and the means to do, as Peter said in 1 Peter 3:15, to give an account of the hope that is within you. It's not enough to just claim, guys, that we believe in God without understanding why such a claim is reasonable and plausible in this cynical world. Christianity, as I tried to talk about last week, it's not a religion of brainwashed goody-two-shoes, you know, who with nothing better to do than just follow blindly. Christianity's never been that way. The basis of true living faith will always lie in evidence, and the Bible testifies to this fact. And if we're soldiers of the cross, we've got to know what that evidence is and why believing in God and believing in Jesus Christ is the most intellectual, reasonable, and only plausible conclusion to derive. And the more evidence that we can learn about, the more convicted we're going to be, and the more willing we're going to be to take that fight on to people who would say otherwise. Okay, so what we're going to do tonight is we're going to look at existence itself as evidence for the existence of God. Okay, we're going to look at existence itself. Now, in doing that, there are things that we are not going to do. First, we are not going to attack atheists. You don't prove a position simply by demeaning a person who holds that point. You prove your position with evidence, and then you show why that evidence does not lean toward their position. Now, we are going to be looking tonight at a couple statements made by probably some very familiar atheists to us, but we're going to address the statements, and we're going to try very hard not to insult the person, okay? So we're not going to do that. We're also not going to necessarily account for God's existence, meaning we're not going to explicitly do that. I do hope by the end of the study that will be an evident thing to us, but before we can account for God's existence, we first need to work out existence itself, meaning the fact that we exist and that the earth itself exists along with all the billions of features that we have in our bodies and on this planet, and the fact that with all these billions of features, we're still just a tiny speck in a much larger universe. So we're also not going to do that. We're not going to confront evolution. If you were here 2 years ago, you got 6 months of that from me, creation versus evolution. If you're interested in that topic, there's just a plethora of PowerPoint slides under the adult resources page on our website. You know, whether a person believes he can plausibly conclude that mankind evolved from lesser creatures doesn't really answer the question of how everything we see and experience around us came into existence in the first place, does it? So the question we're trying to answer is, what caused the universe and everything in it to come into existence? Why is there this thing called reality? Why do we have something that we are all a part of now rather than nothing? And then fourth, as we discuss issues pertaining to evidence, we need to be sure, assured that we're focusing on those things which are plausible and not those things that are merely possible. Now, there are as many possible conclusions as to how things came about as my imagination will allow. I was studying with a guy about 7 years ago about this very topic, and he had all these like crazy ideas about how the Egyptian pyramids were created from these cat deities who came from these like planets that were outside of our galaxy, and the cats came down and showed him how to build these pyramids, and that's why the Egyptians like cats so much. And he was just kind of throwing all that out, and I'm just kind of looking thinking, you know, what are you smoking, dude? And the whole reason he was like coming up with all that stuff was because that's what his imagination, that's where it was going, okay? It was not that he had any evidence. That was just like a possibility. Well, look, I can come up with a million gazillion possibilities of why things happen, but that doesn't mean that it came on the basis of any kind of evidence. You know, if I want to imagine the moon is made of green cheese, I could probably make some arguments to support that position. But in a study on evidences, I'm interested in what is reasonable, what is rational, and what is plausible. We need to discover the most rational and reasonable conclusion for why we have this thing called existence, our universe that we live in. Okay, so we're going to try to logically walk through this. I am going to leave some time for questions, so don't worry about that. I'll give you three or four times for that. All right, so we got this thing that we live in that's called the universe. Don't you love my graphics? By the way, if you're really good at graphics, I will pay you 10 one-on-one Bible studies to help me make my PowerPoints better. So see me after class. I mean, at least 45-minute study, too, I promise, 10 of them. I'm just terrible at this kind of stuff. But we have this thing called our universe, and it either had a beginning or it didn't have a beginning, meaning either something or someone began the universe, or the universe has just always infinitely existed, all right? So let's talk about this. I promise you this will be the most complicated slide that I show you tonight, and it's really not that complicated when you walk through it. This is what we call the second law of thermodynamics, and anybody that's probably a second, third, fourth year engineering student or beyond will understand exactly what this is talking about. But basically what this law says is that in any closed system, a process will always proceed toward a direction in which unavailable energy increases. Now, this is what we call entropy in science. In other words, in any closed system, the amount of disorder always increases with time. Things within our universe naturally progress from order to disorder, from a state of available energy to a state of unavailable energy. I know all this sounds very technical, and it begs the question, do I have to be a PhD in some scientific field to understand all this? Absolutely not. So we can look at this in another way, in a very more, I guess, simplistic example, because I'm sure we have a lot of coffee drinkers in here, right? So here's what I want you to imagine. Imagine that you've got a cup of coffee that is sitting in a perfectly insulated room. That's what we're going to call our closed system. We got a perfectly insulated room. And if that hot cup of coffee is sitting in that room, it's doing what every other hot cup of coffee would do in any situation. It's cooling off. Okay? Now, the amount of total energy in that room is going to remain the same. That's the first law of thermodynamics. A perfectly insulated room guarantees that there's not going to be any increase or decrease in energy. And so when that hot cup of coffee is cooling down in that room, you're not losing energy. The energy is simply being transformed from the coffee's heat to the cool air. When the coffee's hot, there's available energy because the temperature difference between the coffee and the air is there. But as the coffee cools down, the available energy in that coffee is becoming unavailable in energy until it eventually becomes one and the same as room temperature. So at some point, in probably just in a matter of hours in this closed system, there's going to be no temperature difference between the coffee and the air, and all that available energy that used to exist is now going to be in an unavailable state, all right? That's the second law of thermodynamics. Sometimes, if you've ever taken this class, they refer to this as a heat death because the system is dead. There's no more available energy. It's gone. No other work can be performed when you're in a closed system. There's just no way in this closed system that that cup of coffee is going to get hot again all by itself, because in our universe, it is scientifically impossible to turn unavailable energy into available energy. Not while we're bound by the second law of thermodynamics. And if we could figure out a way around that, trillionaire, I don't even know what's after that. That we would have more money than even a trillionaire if we could do that. All right. So let's expand this coffee analogy. Think about our entire universe as one giant closed system where we have billions of hot cups of coffee in it that we call stars. And these stars, just like a hot cup of coffee, they're cooling down. They're losing energy into space. So it kind of begs the question, who put all this energy there in the first place, right? Who put it all there? Who could have produced this colossal amount of energy in an available state in the first place? It could only be someone or something not bound by the second law of thermodynamics. Only the creator of the second law of thermodynamics could create energy in a state of availability in the first place. And so think of it, our universe as like a giant clock. Our entire universe is winding down like a giant clock, ticking down. It's losing available energy. And one day, hopefully a long time from now, our universe is going to undergo a heat death. And so with this clock analogy, the further back that you go in time, the more wound up that clock is going to be. You go far enough back in time and that clock is completely wound up. That's going to be this massive amount of energy that wouldn't even make our universe even capable of being in existence. And so the universe, it cannot be infinitely old. The only plausible conclusion is that our universe had a beginning, and that beginning was caused by someone or something that is operating outside these two laws of thermodynamics, because these are the laws of our universe. Okay, does that make sense? Somebody's thinking, I got a headache. Okay, it's a little complicated. I promise you, this is the most complicated concept we're going to be talking about. Okay, any thoughts on that? Oh, actually, let me show you this, and then I'll take some comments. I do believe that this is evidence for God. Now, that doesn't mean that it's proof yet. Okay. Proof is when there's so much evidence pointing toward a position that you don't really have any choice other than to believe beyond a reasonable doubt not to. And we still have a lot of evidence that we're going to be looking at in this class, and we're going to be taking it all together. And I think that when we do, that's going to prove God's existence. But so far, this is just one piece of evidence, and you be the judge whether this is good or bad evidence. But let me tell you this, evolutionary theories of the universe, they cannot counteract these arguments of the first and second law of thermodynamics. They can't do it. Not even pointing to a Big Bang can account for all the chemical properties and processes that would bring about such a large explosion with all of our elements and the massive amount of energy that would need to happen that occupies our universe, they can't account for that. The further back we attempt to go to try to find a source for all this available energy that we have in our universe, the more plausible it becomes that we hit a singular point, a someone or something not bound by these laws. And here's the cool thing. Did you know that the Bible actually teaches the second law of thermodynamics? Now, not in those words, of course, but look in Psalm 102, verse 25. You can turn in your Bibles, but I do have it on the slide for convenience. Psalm 102, verse 25 and 26 says this: "Of old you founded the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. Even they will perish, but you endure. And all of them will wear out like a garment, like clothing. You will change them, and they will be changed." That's the second law of thermodynamics. And the Hebrew writer quotes this in Hebrews chapter 1, verses 10 through 11, as applying to Jesus Christ. And so even the inspired writers of scriptures knew thousands of years ago, they understood the concept, even if they didn't call it the second law of thermodynamics, they understood the concept that though everything is winding down, they believed that someone with immense power was behind the immutable laws that are within our existence and our universe. All right, does that make sense? Any thoughts, any comments, any questions on that? All right, let's keep walking the path then. Now, not surprisingly, I'm going to tell you this, and I didn't expect anybody to counter me on this. I don't know who all is a Christian who's not necessarily here anymore. I still can't even get to know most of you because all I see are foreheads these days. But here's the interesting thing. Most skeptics and atheists today agree with what we've just stated. Like if a creationist and an atheist were talking about that point we just talked about, you're not going to have any disagreement in the majority of them. Even atheists and skeptics and evolutionists are saying that our universe has not always existed, that something had to create it. Now, we would go further and say it was a someone, but they at least say something brought our universe into existence. Science is still confirming that. Okay, so now what they're trying to do, believing that there is a beginning in our universe, is scientists have been attempting to try to explain that beginning. And so the issue now is whether or not something or someone created the universe, or whether our universe came from nothing, okay? Now, what I want to do is I want to look at a few quotes from a couple very well-known scientists. The first one is Stephen Hawking. Probably most of us recognize him. Stephen Hawking, before he died, suffered for a long time from Lou Gehrig's disease. He was considered, though, while he was alive by many, to be one of the smartest men to have ever lived. And certainly his research in theoretical physics and cosmology is certainly unparalleled. He's written tons of books, published papers. He's won a ton of awards. He was also an atheist while he was alive. Now, in 2010, he wrote this book called The Grand Design. Now, to his credit, he believed what we've already established. He believed that within the confines of our laws, the universe cannot be infinitely old. That would have been an impossibility. He admitted that. All right. But he also believed something had to have created it. And in his book, he attempts to try to explain what that was that brought our evidence into existence. And I want to just read one statement that he made on page 180 of this book. He said, "Because there is a law like gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing." All right, read it again and see if you can find the inconsistencies. I can count at least two of them. "Because there's a law like gravity, the universe can and will create itself from nothing." Anybody find the inconsistencies there? Yeah, Connor?
Someone had to create the law, or something had to create the law of gravity.
Okay. So he said he's attributing gravity as being the source, right? But what does he call gravity? The last word. Nothing. Okay. All right. I don't know about you guys, but I have a problem with this. Okay. So he believes the universe brought itself into existence from nothing, but he calls that nothing gravity. That doesn't make any sense. Okay. Now, I've read this book. I've read the whole book. So there's nothing that's outside of that statement that would change the context of how you just read it. I assure you hear that, at least how I read it anyway. But what I do want to show you from this is that this is a very, this is a very, like, common thing that skeptics will try to do, okay? A very common strategy of skeptics in the scientific community is to try to hijack words and to change their definitions. Virtually every scientist sees the evidence that the universe has not always existed, that it had a beginning, but when it comes to trying to identify whether something or nothing caused it to come into existence, many skeptics will play verbal gymnastics by claiming that something is equal to nothing. Science is another word that is hijacked, unfortunately. So here's the second issue I had with Hawking's quote, and I probably should have left it up there for the slide, but in Hawking's statement, he talked about how the law of gravity created something. No, scientific laws don't make things happen. Scientific laws, such as gravity, they describe why things happen. And there's a big difference. So that's the second inconsistency in what he said. But here's the point. When you truly have nothing, it creates nothing. When you have something, something else created it. I mean, that's just plain logic. And so, you know, you would expect someone, again, a lot of these guys, I mean, I made the point that he's very educated, won a ton of awards, won a bunch of books, a very smart man, but sometimes you need something a little bit more intelligent to actually just see just the plain logic in something, in my opinion. Here's another guy that you might have heard of, Lawrence Krauss. He is another noted physicist. He is also an atheist. He wrote a book called A Universe from Nothing. Now, in this book, Krauss attempts to answer the question, like Hawking did, why there is something rather than nothing. In other words, why is there such a thing as existence? And he boldly claims that the cause of the universe is not God, but rather nothing, citing that there are things happening at the quantum level that dispense a need for God. Okay, so here's what he said. He said, one of the things about quantum mechanics is not only can nothing become something, nothing always becomes something. Nothing is unstable. Nothing will always produce something in quantum mechanics. What's the problem with that statement? No surprises from the last one. What's the problem? I don't know anything about quantum mechanics either, guys. You don't have to see the problem with this statement. All right? Reagan?
For one, it's nothing is unstable.
Okay.
You know, there's still an increasing law of entropy.
Yeah.
So you eventually get to complete chaos. So you're already going past the sixth law.
That's a good point. I hadn't even thought about that one, Reagan. That's absolutely right. There's usually more than one problem with these statements. I was going somewhere else, but I think you hit the nail on the head on that short sentence. So, yeah, very good. Yeah, entropy. If entropy exists, there had to be something that changed into something else, right? Yeah. Well, okay, let me ask you this. Is whatever goes on in the quantum realm, is that something? Is it something? Yeah, it's something, okay? It's not nothing. He says it's nothing, but it is something. And I don't have to know, I don't have to understand the quantum level to know that it's something. I don't have to understand the complexities of quantum physics to know that there's something going on. I know that there are properties. I know that there are laws. So I don't have to have a PhD in this stuff to know when something is something and when nothing is nothing. But here's what I'm trying to say. This is a very common game that a lot of skeptics will sometimes use in order to try to get past the point that someone actually brought our universe into existence. So it's a game they play. It's irrational, and it is absolutely a logical fallacy. Now, like the last time, I want to show you this. There has never been something that has come from nothing, of course, not in this universe. It's never been done in a laboratory. That's never been done. Something always comes from something else. But interestingly, the Bible makes that very point, just like the verse about the second law of thermodynamics. In Romans chapter 4, verse 17, it says, God, I'm skipping a few words, who gives life to the dead and calls into being that which does not exist. In other words, we're not suggesting that outside our universe there was nothing. We're just saying that what brought it into existence is most definitely something. At the very least, and Christians will even go so far to say it is someone, which you're going to get to more in just a moment. All right, does that make sense? Any thoughts on that? Comments? All right, yeah, ready?
There's also the law of matter. Matter isn't created or destroyed, it's only molded. Mm-hmm. So something has to bring the matter into existence. It breaks that law too. You can't actually just pop something into being. That's not how it works.
Yep. That's right. Never been done in a laboratory. But again, if you're going to espouse these hypotheticals, do it on the basis of some actual evidence and not just philosophize. But that's a lot of what is going on in the scientific community today. It's certainly not Francis Bacon's laws, that's for sure. It's just a lot of conjecture and hypothesizing with no evidence behind it. So, any other thoughts? Yeah, Josh.
I took astronomy over the summer, which I didn't learn anything, but one of the things that, I mean, it's, you know, most of school, honestly. One of the videos that we watched, it was like this, it was one of these PhD guys with a super long title. And their whole argument, like there's a timeline that goes back and the top cosmological arguments kind of just have a big question mark as far back as you go. Like they expect that there was like a big bang or some sort of big thing in energy. Some events, right? But before that, they basically say that there couldn't be like something that's bounded by our laws, like we're talking about now. So even then, all the evidence does point towards something, but I think that bias is what determines like this whole issue.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they can't break down and admit that something created the universe because that doesn't seem like it plays well with science anymore. So I think that that really is at the core of this, because even they would tell you, or like a lot of the leading people in this field would say that we don't know. Like, we don't have a clue how this works, but yeah, it works.
Yeah.
So,
you know, the irony, kind of gave me a thought, that the irony of that, Doy Moore and I were talking about this a couple of years ago, is skeptics make fun of us over the virgin birth, right? But if you think about it, even skeptics believe in a virgin birth, don't they? Metaphorically speaking, all right? So, anyway, just something to think about. All right, any other thoughts? Did I say something wrong? You're laughing at me. I say wrong things all the time. So. All right, tell me later. All right, let's keep going. Let's walk through this. If the universe had a beginning and something or someone brought it into existence, the next logical question to ask is whether the universe was caused or uncaused. Okay. In other words, could the universe have brought itself into existence, or did something or someone cause the universe to come into existence? Now, as even like Josh alluded to and Reagan, the natural laws of our universe, they have no exceptions. In other words, the second law of thermodynamics, it's a sure thing within the bounds of existence. And this is also the case with the law of cause and effect, which is one of the most universal and certain of all physical laws. Simply put, the law of cause and effect, or what we call the laws of causality, states that for every material effect, there must be an adequate cause that existed before that effect. So material effects without an adequate cause, that simply doesn't exist in our universe. It never will. Also, what this law states is that no effect is greater than the cause. And that's why scientists state that every effect must have an adequate cause. So for example, a river doesn't become muddy because a frog jumps in it. A book doesn't fall off the table because a fly lands on it. These are not adequate causes for the resulting effect. For whatever effects we see, there is an adequate cause that had to have preceded. Now, children understand this law of cause and effect. They say things to their parents like, Dad, where do apples come from? And Dad will respond, well, son, they come from an apple tree. And then he's going to ask, well, where does the apple tree come from? And Dad's going to respond, well, it comes from an apple. Now, that child is hardly going to be satisfied with those answers. That child wants to know how that first apple tree got here, because even small children can see that there was a cause and they want to know what that cause was. What if Dad said to his kid, well, the apple tree just brought itself into existence? You think the kid's going to buy that? Not likely, because even from the time that we're young, we know intuitively that nothing happens in isolation. Every event can be traced back to one or more events which preceded it and that in fact caused it. And that's why we ask questions like, how did this happen? What caused this? Where did this come from? When did it start? Or more incisively, why did this happen? You know, when we try to trace an event to its cause or causes, we find that we never seem to reach a stopping point. The cause of the event was itself caused by a prior cause, which was affected by a previous cause, and so on. And police investigators on an accident scene use the principles of the law of causality every single day to determine who was ultimately responsible, how things happen. We're going to talk a little bit more about that next week. But one thing we know for sure is that the cause cannot be equal to the effect. That's why a few people buy into the fact that the universe brought itself into existence, because it's already been established. Like Reagan said, matter can't create matter. I could take a rock weighing a pound, and I could perform 1,000 different experiments on that bad boy, and short of changing its state, I'm never going to produce anything new. In the same way, whatever was the cause of this effect that we call existence, the universe in which we live, it cannot be material. That cause had to be something much more. All right? Now, here's a question, and I want you to answer this, because you're going to get this. Who then created God? If you're saying God exists, who created God?
Don't you think you're going to get that when you start talking about the law of cause and effect?
You might have heard it. How do you answer? How do you think you should answer?
Well, the definition of God itself is something that was always there. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's omnipotent. He's outside of that realm.
That's right. That's exactly right. So it does beg the question, what kind of God are you thinking about? You're not using God in the same way that we know him from what we know about God. That's a very good point. Yeah. So we're going to piggyback off that in a second time. So anybody else got any other thoughts?
Yeah. So like, when someone's asked me before, I've kind of gone to the fact that it's a more philosophical question than a scientific question. Because philosophy is the study of essentially why, mm-hmm. what the cause of things. And that does implement science on the I mean, whichever route you take, you're going to get something that had to be created by something else. And,
yeah.
And that's why you can't answer that with a scientific way, because it's a definite situation. Right? And you have to end up going with philosophy or something like that, because there's no other answer. There's no solid answer.
Yeah, it's really the same problem that you get with trying to assume that the universe is infinitely always in there, right? I mean, if you're going to say that God is bound by the laws of cause and effect, you're going to have to go back further and figure out who created him, yeah. And, of course, certain deists would claim that, but they definitely hit brick walls. Any other thoughts? Or I can give you my answer anyway. Any other thoughts? Yeah.
I think it was Ken Ham, Genesis 1:1, and the God created the heavens and the earth. Space, time, and matter.
Yeah.
God created it, and he's outside of them.
Right. Yeah, that's where I was going. Yeah. Ken Ham, is that the guy that debated the science dude? What's the science dude? Bill Nye? Is that it? Yeah, okay. Science guy. Yeah. Ooh. All right. So to piggyback off all three of those, the very question itself is nonsensical. We're thinking of the wrong God. Because the God of the Bible, as was just alluded to, it's not affected by time, space, and matter. If he's affected by time, space, and matter, he's not God. Time, space, and matter, when you think about those three things, that's what we call a continuum. And they all had to come into existence together. That had to have happened. Because if there was no matter, or if there was matter but no space, where would you put it? And if there was matter and space but no time, then when would you put it? So these three things had to come into existence at the same time. And the Bible declares how this happened in 10 very short words. In the beginning, there's your time. God created the heavens, there's your space, and the earth, okay? There's your matter, all right? And what this is alluding to is a trinity of trinities, right? Because in the beginning, time is made up of past, present, future, right? Space is made up of height, width, depth, okay? Matter is made up of solids, liquids, and gas, right? Okay, so a trinity of trinities. And if you look further in Genesis 1, there's another trinity as well, right? So a trinity of trinities, all right? So they all had to come here instantaneously, and the God who created them must be above them, and he must be outside of them, making him the first uncaused cause, independent, not subject to the demands of those laws. This is the one uncaused cause from which we see every effect and every experience that we see in this mature world derives. Now, again, the Bible sort of alludes to this. Paul said in Acts 17, 28 and 29, he tells the Greeks, "For in him we live and move and exist, as even some of your own poets have said, for we also are his children, being then the children of God. We ought not to think that the divine nature is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and thought of man." The idea is if he's limited to those things, gold, silver, or stone, he's not God. So the question, who or what created God, that's limiting God. That's not the definition of God. If you could fit God in my 3-pound brain, he certainly wouldn't be worth worshiping. That's just not how it works. Psalm 90, verse 2, is also a really good verse. I'll read that since I don't really have the, it verbatim up there. Psalm 90, verse 2 says, before the mountains were born, or you gave birth to the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. He is from everlasting to everlasting, and that's how he introduces himself to Moses at the burning bush in Exodus 3, the great I am, not the I was, not the I will be, not the I am for now. He's not limited by past, present, or future. He is the I am. He's the eternal God. He's the uncaused cause from which every effect in existence derives and finds its being. And the Bible certifies this fact as well as logic. So, all right, any thoughts on that before we look at the last point? Cool. All right. So, is there evidence in existence for there being a personal God behind existence, a someone rather than a something? Is there evidence in the universe that an adequate mind was behind this great effect that we call existence? Now, we know, again, that matter and energy cannot spontaneously arrange itself, and we've already proven that the most plausible conclusion based on the physical laws of our universe is that our universe had a beginning. If those things are the case, then the beginning of our universe was the result of a decision. And decisions are made when there is a mind involved. And a mind belongs to not a something, but a mind belongs to a someone, a personal being. And so just from that logic alone, our universe had to be the result of a decision by someone, someone great, to act with specificity, to bring into existence everything it is that we experience. I have a very simple illustration, and this is going to kind of be the launching pad for our next study next week. But suppose that you are hiking in the wilderness, and you're hundreds of miles from civilization, and you come across a stack of rocks that looks like that. Now, there are two conclusions that you can draw about how this stack of rocks appeared in this specific arrangement. First, you could conclude that nature itself did this as a result of spontaneous causes, maybe a combination of the wind, the water, a shift in the magnetic poles, or something like that. Somehow, just a freak accident caused all these rocks to be aligned in this way, okay? Now, when you go hiking and you see something like that, is that the conclusion that you come up with? What do you conclude was the cause of that simple thing right there?
Somebody built it.
Somebody built it, right? Somebody did it. Someone else had been here and made a decision to stack these rocks. Now, in fairness, both of these conclusions are possible, okay? I mean, no matter how seemingly impossible that nature caused this, I'll say that it's within the realm of possibility, I guess. But that's not what we're interested in when we're talking about evidences, is it? Not in a courtroom and just not in everyday life. What we want to know is which is more plausible. And we all know the answer. Every single one of us knows the conclusion we would draw if we saw that in the wilderness, that it's much more likely that someone had been there. Someone with a will decided to leave evidence of the fact that they had been there in hopes that a faraway traveler would stumble upon that evidence. And that's where we come to God. Because if we can naturally conclude this about a simple design, such as a stack of rocks in the woods, how could we not conclude the same thing about this infinitely more complex design that we call our universe? I do believe the most plausible evidence points to a personal being who made a decision to bring our universe into existence, being there, and that there was purpose behind that. And he also left us evidence to have plausible cause to believe in his existence. And that is what we call general revelation. And that's what David spoke about in Psalm 19, verse 1 through 4, when he said, the heavens proclaim the glory of God. The skies display his craftsmanship day after day. They continue to speak night after night. They make him known. They speak without a sound of word. Their voice is never heard, yet their message is gone throughout the earth and their words to all the world. You know, if God has left us evidence of his existence, which I think the vast majority of us believe that he has, it means he wants to be found, and it means he wants us to find him. And that means we are not insignificant blobs of flesh created spontaneously to merely live a meaningless life here on this planet, only to die without any hope of something else past this life. We are here for a much greater purpose than that. So that's why I think evidence points to the existence, or existence points to the existence of God, if that makes sense. All right. Next week, we are going to dig further. We are going to look into design itself in our universe and see if that design speaks to chaos or if it speaks to intelligent design, if I can use that term. So, before we end, anybody got any thoughts they want to add into your talk about? Any questions? All right, Ben. It's 40 after. I think we're done. Thanks, guys.